Hello, welcome to another episode of Tank Nuts. I'm super pleased today to welcome a very special guest. It's a chap who served with the US Air Force Special Operations as a helicopter gunner, saw active service in Afghanistan and Iraq, to name but a few, numerous TV appearances, opened his own gun shop, a radio personality, and is currently the gunsmith for DriveTanks.com. A bit more about them later on. It's my good friend, Mr. Glenn Fleming. How are you, Glenn?
I'm good, man. How are you doing, bud?
I'm all right. I think I missed a couple out there. I think it was also very good on the guitar and wrote a couple of books with a third on the way, isn't it?
Yeah. I'm not so good on the guitar. I hadn't played much lately. But I've got two books out on Amazon, and the third one's coming out. Actually, as soon as I'm done editing it, I'll go ahead and publish it, and it'll be out.
And I have to say, Glenn, you are one of the most relaxed people I've ever met. We met, I think, about, oh my goodness, it must be two, three years even ago now.
It was a while ago, wasn't it?
And we'll talk a bit more about, obviously, Drive Tanks a bit later on. So, Glenn, you've been well. How are you coping there with the pandemic and the world ending at the moment?
Yeah, right. It's all apocalypse everywhere. And as far as apocalypses go, this one kind of sucks. I'm kind of disappointed in it. But it's going all right, you know? I mean, I know some people who had it, and they've been fine. I just kind of take the whole thing in stride. Like, you know me, man. I'm a pretty mellow guy.
Pretty mellow guy, to say the least.
Yeah.
So to kick us off, Glenn, let's go back to, not the beginning, but obviously your time in the US Air Force. Now, what I know about the Air Force in general, regardless which country you're in, you could write in a postage stamp. I'm a tank man, as you know, so I know nothing about this. So what sort of, I mean, in the first place, how did you come around to decide that the Air Force was for you?
Well, my dad was in the Air Force, and, you know, it started me being interested in planes. I was always into, like, World War II planes and Vietnam-era jets and stuff like that. And one day I woke up, and I was, like, 23, and I didn't really have anything career-wise going on. I'm like, screw it, I'll join the military. So I joined the Air Force as a weapons guy. And I found out a couple years into it that I could cross-train into being a helicopter gunner, which was the best thing I ever did. So I went through a battery of tests, physical, mental, all that other stuff. And I actually did a year of training once I passed all the tests and got approved. And then became a helicopter gunner in MH-53J Pavlos, the Air Force Special Operations bird. And it was best job of my life, man. A lot of people come in here and they're like, oh man, this must be the best job you ever had. I'm like, no, second best.
So what's the role of, I mean, you know, again, forgive my ignorance. All I see of helicopter gunner is you sit there and it's probably learned from Vietnam things and that sort of films and that sort of thing.
Oh, yeah.
So what's the role of it, of a gunner? Do you just sit there with the gun all the time? Or
Sometimes, man, actually shooting the guns are a pretty small part of what you do, because you're doing fast rope infills, you're doing extractions, you're resupplying, you're doing all kinds of stuff. So you're pretty busy throughout. Just, you know, your gunnery is kind of it's a necessary thing, but it's kind of a secondary thing. Because the one thing you always got to keep in mind when the bad guys are shooting at you and they're missing, if you start shooting at them, tracers work both ways. And we flew at night pretty much exclusively. So they didn't know where we were. They just shot at a noise, you know. But as soon as you let loose with a minigun or a 50 cal, they're like, oh, there they are. And then they start popping at you, you know.
And you saw service first. Where was the first place you got deployed to then?
Oh, man. I was deployed usually about 300 days out of the year. And I was in for a little over 14 years. But I volunteered for everything. I enjoyed it, you know. Operation Southern Watch, Northern Watch, Afghanistan, Iraq, Bosnia, Africa. The Bosnia thing I did when I was in a weapons troop still. The rest of it was aerial gunnery stuff. Just all over the place, man. I've been all over the world. Really, really dug it a lot.
And was this where your passion for small arms came from, or was this always something which you've been super interested in?
Yeah, I've always been into guns. I mean, my grandfather was big into guns, hunting and stuff like that. And me being me, when I was like 5, 6 years old, I started messing around with guns, just shooting them 22s and stuff like that. And later on, I started getting into the more, I guess you could call it the exotic weaponry, like really liking the MG-34s, stuff like that. Of course, when I was, you know, teenager, I didn't have any access to them. But that kind of carried over into my Air Force career. And then when I got out, I needed a hobby, and I found out you could build guns in your home. So I was like, well, crap, I can do that. So I started building guns, and just turned into a job and turned into a really good career for me. Worked out really well.
And at some stage you said you opened your own gun shop.
Yeah. I opened, oh, there's Josh. Where's he at?
That's fine. Hi, Josh.
So yeah, I opened my own gun shop in Lafayette, Louisiana. I owned it for about 3 or 4 years. I really dug it. The freedom of having your own, of being the boss is really nice. However, the complexity of owning a gun shop and federal regulations, state regulations, and I hate to say it, but customers, not all of them, but some of them, kind of drives you up the wall. So and hiring and firing and all that, I didn't really care for being the boss in those aspects. So I gave up the shop to my partner. And when I had the opportunity, they offered me a job here. And I was like, well, hell yeah, this is awesome. You know, come out here and do tank stuff. Yeah.
Well, I always remember the first time we visited there, and I said, we'll talk about drive tanks in a moment. But we had this lengthy conversations, because for us, I think it's sometimes hard for us, A, to appreciate the sort of the gun culture that you've got in the States as opposed to what we've got in Europe. Because when you say, you know, I was firing a gun at a certain age, I owned a gun shop and this sort of thing. And, I mean, it's quite an incredible conversation to have sometimes. It's, I mean, for me, the first time, obviously, we really come across guns. I mean, my grandfather had a shotgun. That was about it. That's the only thing I ever experienced until I joined the British Army. And then, of course, but it's just such a different way of looking at things. Now, I'm not going to, whether it's right or wrong, or I'm not going into all the politics of it and all the rest of it, but it's a fascinating topic of conversation, I find.
Oh, it's night and day, no doubt, man. And one of the weird things that's kind of out there, I know in the UK you can have deactivated machine guns and stuff like that. Well, in America, you can't have machine guns unless you go through the background checks and all that other stuff. But our deactivation requirements are actually to chop the gun in a bunch of different pieces, which is where I come into play. I make them live again. But in the UK, your deactivation ways are actually very easy to make a live machine gun out of, where ours is really hard to make a live machine gun out of. So, but with y'all's current gun rules, I never kind of got that. But it's cool, you know. You actually have something you can play with and look at and enjoy. So that's cool.
Funny enough, I'm pretty sure they're changing all that at the moment, because now you have to go through, you used to be able to buy a replica gun almost from anywhere, but now they've changed it recently.
Oh, really?
You have to go through background checks as well. But but I mean, it's a fantastic conversation. So training to be, would you call it a gun? I mean, in the British Army, we call it a gun fitter. That's what we sort of the terminology for it. So the training for that, how long is it?
The military wise, It was pretty simple. I mean, a couple months of learning the minigun and the 50 cal M4, M203 40 mic grenade launcher, stuff like that. There's not a lot of stuff. You know, you learn how to take it apart, learn how to mess with it, learn how to fire accurately, and do whatever you need to do with it. But on the outside, when I started working with guns, I don't really have any formal training. I just kind of learned as I went along and turned out I was good at it.
What's the fascination with it? The mechanics of it, or
yeah. I've always liked taking things apart, and I like guns, so you combine the two. It's like, hey, this is great. And luckily, I can take things apart and put them back together again, usually. So that's a good step in the right direction.
Now, moving on to obviously your current job, is that where you are at the moment? And you're actually
I'm in the office here, drive tanks.
And drive tanks, I can see. I mean,
Well, it's hard to point with this stuff going on. Well, over here, over this shoulder, there's a machine gun right there.
And what sort of machine gun is that, Glenn?
That's an RPD. I figured you had tanks behind you. I needed a visual aid, too. So.
And a coffee machine. Is that a coffee machine on the other side, or is that something more exotic?
No, it's a cigar humidifier.
A cigar humidifier.
Yeah, I got a couple guys here who smoke cigars.
So drive tanks, Glenn. How would you describe drive tanks to somebody that's never heard of it before?
Man, we're like Disney World with better rides. I mean,
I
got
knew you'd think of a much better way to describe it than I would.
We don't have the big giant mouse going around, but we do have giraffes, so that kind of makes up for it.
I have to say, for anybody that doesn't, the first time I went there, and just to sort of put it in perspective, you're in, what's the name of the place you're in?
Middle of nowhere.
Yeah, I was going to say the middle. I was trying to think the nearest town. Where was the nearest town we stayed?
Oh, the nearest town is Uvalde, which is, we're about 30 minutes outside of that, and that's about 2 hours west of San Antonio. And so Uvalde's right, just a little bitty town, you know.
You're right up on the border, aren't you, on the Mexican border?
Yeah, we're about 40, 50 miles away from it. We see, not on the ranch, but, you know, going down the road, we'll see illegals walking down the road every once in a while.
And I have to say, the first time we went there, it is absolutely, I say, it's very hard for us to really comprehend it. So you go through these, like, double gates at the end.
Yeah.
And then you drive. And it's probably, I don't know, it must be another 10-minute drive up until you've got this big ranch house. I mean, the acreage you've got there is unbelievable.
Yeah, we got about 18,000, which is a pretty decent-sized ranch. I used to think it was like the biggest ranch ever, but I did some work for a guy in El Paso, and he had a ranch that was 500,000 acres.
Oh, my word.
That's basically, he owned Rhode Island. But if you've ever been to El Paso, it's all dirt and sticks, and there's nothing out there. So, but it's really cool to say, yeah, I own 500,000 acres, or 18,000 acres for that matter.
And one of the first things I saw there, again, people just won't believe this, was giraffes. I mean, you're driving through this ranch, and there's, I believe one of them is called Daisy, if Daisy's still around. Buttercup, that's it. Buttercup, I knew it was something to do with Buttercup.
Yeah, she's still around. We actually have between 12 and 15 giraffes now. I don't remember how many, but that's just the giraffes are just a small part of what we got out here. We actually have, like, currently over 90 species. We're getting rhinos, so that's kind of cool. We're part of a conservation program for rhinos. So that'll be really neat. I've never petted a rhino before, so
that'll
be new.
I mean, it's incredible. And then you've got this incredible real estate, and drivetanks.com is sort of part of the bigger ranch, isn't it? It's sort of a subsector of it. And you drive up from there and you get to your guy's place. And I have to say, your actual area reminded me probably of the best British Army training area that we've got in the UK. It was probably about the same size of real estate you've got there.
Speaking of which, you got to come out again, man. We've actually got a lot more stuff now, and we've made the facilities bigger. So you got to come out and check it out, man.
Love to. When I can actually get outside of the UK without having to do quarantine and everything.
Yeah, it's rough right now,
It'd be fantastic. And I have to say, one of the things that hit me there, now obviously, of course, we've got a lot of museums in Europe, hundreds of museums dedicated to armoured warfare throughout the countries. But it's the only place I've ever been to where you can actually live fire some of these vehicles and the small arms you've got. And I do believe it's sort of like sold on the advertising is the only place in the world, I believe, that you can actually live fire some of these vehicles.
Pretty much. There's one other place you can live fire the things, but we're an actual accredited museum. So we have a lot of stuff that just a lot of artifacts and stuff that varies from World War I on up to current stuff. And that's not even mentioned tanks, machine guns, artillery, flamethrowers. Yeah, you name it, we got it.
And still talking about the tanks you've got there. So I recall when we were there, certainly you had the Sherman T-34, Leopard 2, I believe.
Leopard 184.
Leopard 184. Chieftain, which made me laugh because nobody has Chieftains. But your driving area you've got there. So it's really an event day out for folks that want to take it to the next level.
Oh, yeah, we're a bucket list item for people, you know. I mean, you come out and say, hey, I want to drive we have it now, the T-72 or we got a whole bunch of stuff. Yeah, we got a bunch of Leopard 185s now. We got a Stug 3 off D, I believe it is. So that's really cool. I like having that here. We've grown quite a bit since you've been here, so we got a whole bunch of new stuff.
Well, it's absolutely fantastic. And the big thing for me was, I mean, obviously live firing is just unheard of. So to put it in some sort of perspective, when we were there visiting you, we live fired a Sherman, which is absolutely incredible. Yeah.
Actually, hold up just a second. I got a visual aid. All right, get situated again. So as you know, we have a PAC-40, right? And the PAC-40 is a 75mm German anti-tank gun, World War II. This is the shell. This is the bullet. Wow. It weighs about 12 pounds, goes around, we don't really know. We can't find a chronometer big enough. But we think it's around 25 to 3,000 feet per second. So that's moving. And we shoot at cars because, you know, we hate cars.
And I said, I mean, it just gives you an idea of the real estate you've got there, because the safety templates for firing this sort of stuff are huge.
Yeah, it's, you have to have a huge backstop. We basically have a mountain that we cut into, you know, made it fade the face of it sheer, and we put the car in front of that and shoot directly into the car, into the mountain.
And you make your own ammunition. I mean, this is this was just unbelievable. I always recall we walked into this room being shown around there, and there was ammunition being made. It was
The room I'm in now.
A truly. Yeah.
We make everything 20 millimeter and above. We have to make it, because let's face it, you're not going to go out and find any live Sherman rounds to shoot.
And how did the idea of Drive Tax come about then, Glenn? Who was the sort of like, you know, the brain, what was the brainchild behind it?
Well, honestly, this happened while I was working in my own, or owning my own shop. Yeah. And I was making machine guns for a company called Paradigm SRP. They do a gyro-stabilized sniper platform. It's really cool, by the way. But they called me up one day and they're like, hey, man, the owner of the ranch wants a tank. Okay. So I went out and found them in Sherman, and they flew me up to Maine to check it out, and checked out great. You know, didn't have a live gun on it at the time, but it was just off of restoration. So it was a cherry tank. It was really nice. So I went up there, I came back. I was like, yeah, you want to buy this? So they bought it, and it was just something for the owner to screw around on, just to say he had a tank. But this is a hunting ranch, and they had the hunters going, man, I want to drive that. So, you know, they're like, ping. So that kind of let off the light bulb. And they're like, well, we can charge people to do this. Put a live gun in it. We can charge people to do this. And it took off so well that we are where we're at right now, which is a pretty decent sized organization.
And guests you get there, I mean, what sort of folks do you, I obviously follow you on social media, that it seems to be that the variety of people that visit you for this experience are, I mean, it's across the board completely.
Yeah, yeah, it runs the gamut, man. I mean, of course, we get the diehard tank people, the diehard gun people. But one of my personal favorite things that we get is the people who aren't into either. They just kind of want to come out and just check stuff out. But by the end of the day, I try to convert them into being tank and gun people.
Obviously your passion is for the small arms as well. We're gonna have to talk about the small arm collection there. So I always remember going into when you enter your place, there's like a hangar, isn't there, and you've got a lot of stuff on the wall. Just run us through, Glenn, some of the small arms that you've got in there.
Oh man, we got over 100 guns and stuff like that, not including artillery guns, but I mean RPD, MG42, MG34, Russian DT, Russian PKMs. We actually got 3 PKMs. M60s, M4s, AK-47s. I mean, if you can think of it, pretty much we got it.
And you just, I mean, but how do you get hold of this stuff? I mean, is it just...
Some of it I made from parts kits.
Oh, like wow. About
probably a third of it. You know, that's my forte. And some of it we got from various collectors and stuff like that. There's actually a pretty thriving machine gun community in the United States. You got like gun people, then machine gun people, then you got artillery people, then you got tank people. It gets smaller and smaller the more further in you go. And once you're in there, once you know a couple people, you pretty much know everybody.
And what would you say is the favorite experience down there? What most people want?
Shoot the Sherman.
I was going to say it's got to be Sherman. Yeah. I would have thought from the small arms side, it's probably, I don't know, German or something.
MG42. pretty easily, yeah.
Which I have to say is one of my favorites.
Oh, it's a great gun.
What about safety, though, Glenn? I mean, I can obviously, from my experience in the Army, I mean, a range period was, I mean, to start with, it's a lot of organization putting it all together in the first place. But we're talking about here, you know, trained soldiers. I mean, do you not have palpitations when you've got certain people out
sometimes
in the range?
Sometimes, like I said, a lot of these people, well, quite a few of these people have never shot a gun before. And they're like, hey, I want to shoot the MG42, which is, you know, kind of quite the step up to start with. But, I'm a range official, so I go out there and I'm the safety guy. So I always try, you know, we like to keep it lighthearted and fun, but we also, in the back of our minds, have to have safety paramount because, you know, these are weapons. I mean, let's face it, they can do damage if used wrong, and it's our job to make sure they're not.
Have you got a favorite amongst everything? Personal favorite?
Oof. Personal favorite machine gun is either the MG42 or the HK-53. Personal favorite on the artillery is hands down the PAC-40. That's my favorite thing to shoot out here, period. Because when you shoot that thing, it's got a muzzle brake on it, which directs a blast back towards you. And it's like being kicked in the chest. It's just a really neat experience. Rings your bell, and you're kind of like, for the first second you after you shoot it, you're like, well, what the hell just happened? Where am I? And then you come to your senses, and they're like, oh, crap, I just shot this big thing. It's a really neat experience.
As I said, for us, it was the first experience, certainly of firing the Sherman. And I have to say, I was really intrigued. I mean, I assume this is just safety, is it? But you actually, when you're firing the Sherman, for example, you don't actually get inside to fire it.
Yeah.
Obviously, like you would, you've got, I don't know, like a lead or something coming from it. Or
yeah, there's actually two reasons for that. One, of course, is safety, like I said. The breech ring is 77 years old, something like that, and it's going to explode one day. It's just going to happen. Law of averages. Nobody knows when that is, and if you're inside the tank when that happens, bye. Yeah. But the other reason is it's actually boring to shoot from a tank from the inside. I've done it once, and you look through the scope, you're looking at the target, you shoot, tank rocks, you can't see your target anymore, little puff of dirt, a little puff of smoke from inside, gun comes back, and that's about it. It's not even that loud. And that's by design. You know, you don't want to rupture the whole crew with a tremendous force inside the tank. So it's actually a lot more visceral doing it from outside the tank.
And, I mean, do you work on the tank main armaments as well?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I'm responsible for all the guns out here. Artillery, tank guns, machine guns. I'm a flamethrower smith now, too, so.
Funny enough, I didn't get a chance to, something I always regret, we didn't get a chance to have a go on the flamethrower. But
oh, that's cool, man. That's a neat experience, man. It is really, there's two things in this museum I can tell you about. I can show you videos, pictures, this whole thing. But until you do it, you just don't know. One of them's a PAC-40 and the other one's a flamethrower. And they're just amazing. They're kind of terrifying at the same time, but they're really, really cool.
I was just going to say that the idea of a flamethrower has always been, you know, I don't know, just terrifying to me, terrifying from a history perspective as well when it was used. And is that what do you find the hardest vehicle to work on? Is there something?
Oh, right now, the T-34. T-34, hands down. They used leather seals in the gun recuperating the recoil mechanism. And actually, currently, it's down because of that. The leather seals got some moisture on them somehow, rusted to the rest of the chamber, and I can't get the damn bolt out. So I'm trying to do some experimenting to see how I can get it out without actually having to pull the whole gun and mantle it out of the tank, which is not something I'm looking forward to at all. But that's been my biggest pain.
How do you get on with spares? I mean, surely these things we're talking that they're just, some of the spares don't exist anymore.
Yeah, that's true. Some of them you can find stuff out there, like some guy, I don't know, let's say a breech ring or something like that. Some guy has a breech ring he's been using for a fishing weight or something like that. He just doesn't know what it is. And the rest of the stuff you make, we have a little machine shop in the back that if I need something that I just can't find, I'll go ahead and make it.
Wow. And if you had to say, you know, what would you like to see in the collection that you haven't got? Dream idea.
Ooh. I want to see a live Panzer IV or a Panzer III or a Flak 38. I really want a Flak 38 in here. Those are just really cool. But yeah.
Going back to then, I know you've appeared in certain TV shows and episodes and things. Did you have a favorite there? When you appeared, you appeared on TV a few times, I know.
Yeah, I was on one show on Discovery for like 4 years. That was a lot of fun because I went from being a regular gunsmith who worked on machine guns sometimes to a guy who worked on artillery and everything else all the time. And that kind of got me where I am. And then the other one was one called The Weapons Hunter. I think it was on History Smithsonian Channel, something like that. But that was the one I had the most fun on. There was a guy named Paul who was the host of that show, and me and him get along really well, and we still talk and hang out and stuff when we can. So I have, you know, every kind of TV show. I don't know if you ever did it, messed around with any TV, but TV is like you got a week to film a whole episode, and in that week you got to go because they're like, well, you got to do this, okay, but you got to do this first. So you can't just concentrate on what the original thing you're supposed to do. You have all this other stuff you have to do. So it really kind of gets you in the mood of being able to take things and do it quickly, which I kind of dig.
And what's all this? I hear you're doing a radio show at the moment.
Well, I did. I did it for about 4 years on a local station in Lafayette. Yeah, I really enjoyed it, man. I mean, radio, TV and radio are night and day, man. I liked radio better because in TV, if you mess something up, if you say a curse word, you just do it again. It's no big deal. In radio, if you say a curse word, you said a curse word. There's no taking that back. So I really, because it keeps you on your toes, you know, and you get calls in from people and they're asking questions and you got, like I said, it keeps you on your toes. And I really, really dug the radio aspect.
And what was the premise of the show then? What were you talking about? Just a general show?
Yeah, pretty much. It was called Firearms Friday, where I'd talk about the local, local and national firearms industry, what was going on with the laws and stuff like that. And I'd take in caller questions that had to do with whatever they wanted to talk about, you know. I dug it. I'd like to do it again, but just out here in the middle of nowhere, it's just internet reception isn't the greatest. So being on the phone for that long just didn't work out sometimes.
And what's the future looking like, Glenn? What are you up to?
I got a couple projects in the works. Like I said, one, I got the books, and I'm going to keep writing those because I found I really enjoy them. I'll just keep working here, having a good time.
And what's happening with Drive Tanks? I mean, you were saying there that you're expanding a bit. What are the plans?
Yeah, we're constantly expanding. I mean, we're waiting on new tanks now, which I can't talk about, but they're cool.
Okay, fair enough.
Waiting on a couple new pieces of artillery, machine guns, and we get new stuff all the time. I just finished a Russian KPV 14.5 millimeter anti-aircraft gun. But we're waiting on a mount for it before I can actually test fire it because it's big.
Is there like nothing you can't fire there? I mean, it seems pretty incredible to me.
No, not really. No, I mean there's one gun, a ZB-37, that's a dummy gun that I built for my daughter when she was 3, because there's a whole backstory to this.
I was going to say, Glenn, I mean, why are you building guns for your daughter age 3?
Well, she didn't have one. She didn't have a machine gun, right? But no. There was this guy who brought in a Chinese Maxim, gorgeous gun, had a little issue with it, and it had a little seat on it, and then you sit in a little seat and move it around and shoot. And when it was in the shop, my daughter, when she was like 2 or 3, would sit on the seat and pretend she was shooting, make little gun noises. And when we fixed it and it left, she was really sad. So I'm like, oh crap, I got to make her a machine gun now. So I made her the ZB-37. It's not live, but it's hers, and she likes it.
Well, that is the ultimate father. Do I think you're saying something there about prospective suitors for her or something, boyfriends and that?
Exactly.
So, Glenn, the books, you're now a fully fledged author.
Yep.
2 books under your belt. I think one in the pipeline.
Yes, sir.
I'm assuming they're about machine guns. Maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah. They're the first two are really niche market books, man. I never expected to sell a bunch of them, but I just kind of wrote them for me. And the first one's about kind of a general overview of how you look at machine gun maintenance, how you fix a couple different guns, and how you actually build a machine gun. And the reason I did that is because, you know, there's a bunch of gunsmith schools in the United States, but none of them deal with machine guns. So you have to apprentice under somebody or just kind of figure it out like I did as you went on. So I think that kind of helped a bunch of people out. I'd like to think it did. The second one's dealing specifically with blowback machine guns, just maintenance, repair, stuff like that. The third one, however, though, I'm really kind of digging working on that, is about a beginner's guide to guns, just regular old guns. Because there's been a real uptick in the market here in the United States since all the madness has started. I mean, guns are flying off the shelf. It's really hard to find one right now. And unfortunately, a lot of those people are new shooters. That's cool. But some of them just, quite honestly, don't know what they're getting into, don't know what they're doing. So this book is designed for them, you know, how to select a gun, what you want the gun for, be it personal protection or just going out target shooting or something like that. And deals a little bit with holsters and accessories and stuff you can buy, but not a lot. There's just so many of those that it'd fill up a book by itself just on one aspect of holsters. So it's kind of a newbie's guide to guns, and it's a short book because I don't want to inundate people with a bunch of knowledge they don't really need. I want to keep it basic, simple, to the point, and this is what you should be looking at doing. So, yeah, I'm really happy with the third one. Hopefully it sells a million, and I'll be like Stephen King or something.
And you can retire.
Yeah, yeah.
So here's a tester for you then, Glenn. I am, if I was Joe Average, I'm out. Mm-hmm. I just want a gun because I'm worried about the climate at the moment. I'm worried about my personal safety. What would you recommend then?
Well, the first thing I'd tell you is to go ahead and go to a bunch of different gun shops and go ahead and mess with all the guns you can. Don't just go into one and say, oh, that looks pretty, I'll buy that. Because it might be the wrong gun for you. Let's say a woman comes into a shop and, she's on the slim side or something like that and never owned a gun before. 1911-45, not the gun for her, man. Not the gun for her. But something like a little Glock 43 or something might be perfect. But, unfortunately, there's a lot of bad gun knowledge out there. Her husband might be a 1911 guy. So, oh, you need 45 for stopping power. Not realizing it's too much gun for her. So the first thing you want to do is go out to a bunch of different gun shops, look at a bunch of different guns, put your hands on them, see which grip fits you real well. And you can go to ranges in the United States, indoor ranges, and they'll rent pistols. So if you go out and rent a couple pistols, you get a feel for them and you kind of find what you like. Then once you find what you like, then you go ahead and buy it. And you'll be a lot happier because, guns are expensive, man. They're not cheap. And you want to get into something that you're going to enjoy shooting that's not going to intimidate you right off the bat.
Wow. So you can try before you buy.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. Yeah. So I could, like everything else, you wouldn't just go into like Chevy and buy just the first car you see because it's got big tires on it.
My wife would buy it depending on what color it was. So
the cool thing about that is you can buy whatever gun you want and you can get this stuff done called Cerakote. And our Duracote, and you can coat it whatever color you want it to be. So it doesn't have to be pink to start with, but it can be pink when you end up.
So, Glenn, thanks again for taking the time out. Really, really appreciate it. It's lovely to catch up with you. Look after yourself. Look after the family. Stay safe out there. I don't think you'll have any problems on the ranch. You're pretty well armed up there. but it's been a real pleasure. So thanks again for that.
Same here, man. It's good seeing you again, bud.
And to everybody listening, thanks for listening. If you enjoy this podcast, the greatest compliments that we could all have is to subscribe, leave us some feedback. If you want to ask any questions of Glenn or the other guests that we've had on there, please feel free to drop us a line, a message on Facebook. It's probably easiest at WG Challenger. And until next time, look after yourselves.